making the town slightly tilted and confusing to look at. And no one was rich. Not in the way of the Fire Nation and Earth Kingdom capitals, or self-sufficient cities like Omashu and Gaoling. As they walked through the outskirts, passing haggard stallkeepers, peddlers selling rusted tools, staring mothers holding children at their hips, Kiyoshi recognized the same symptoms in North Chungling as in Yokoya. Trying to scrabble against unyielding soil wore down on a person in a particular way. Kiyoshi realized the vaunted Fire Nation prosperity that other countries sometimes envied was a bit of a stage trick. Whether it was intentional or not, the capital took up most of what outsiders imagined as the Fire Nation, due to its smaller size compared to the Earth Kingdom. And the capital would always look fine as a point of pride, hiding weaknesses, never lacking for anything. "Let's do some reconnaissance and explore the fairgrounds," Heiran said. "The man we're looking for is named Nyahitha. He's of the Banti tribe, though he prefers not to make that known. Out of respect, we should feign ignorance of his background." "Who are the Banti tribe?" Kiyoshi asked. "Exactly," Heidon said, giving her a pointed stare. They walked farther into town, in the direction of the sea. Rongi's irritation grew with every step. A stranger might have assumed that the haughty-looking girl was turning her nose up at the hardships of the common folk on display. But Kiyoshi knew her better than that. "What's your issue with this place?" she whispered. "You've been against coming here from the start." "It's a carnival town," Rongi muttered. "A glorified gambling den. North Chungling used to be known as a place where spiritual experiences were common, and anyone could see a vision of the other world, not just the enlightened. But instead of maintaining its hallowed ground, the village cashed in on its reputation. People come here to pay for a spiritual encounter, and once they're bored of that, cheap entertainment." Kiyoshi hadn't known such options existed. If she could pay to talk to Yang Chen, she would. She'd empty any one of the numerous accounts Janju had bequeathed her. "It's not real," Rongi said, knowing exactly what Kiyoshi was thinking. "The success stories are from tourists unwilling to admit they wasted their money, and it sullies the very nature of the spirits. If I were the Avatar and the only way I could make a profound leap was to grease the palm of a stage medium, I'd bury my head in shame." They'd have to agree to disagree on that front. Rongi trudged on a few paces before her expression softened. "Still, the town shouldn't be this run down," she said. "There must have been as much trouble with the harvests as Lord Zoryu said. It's as bad as...
as the Earth Kingdom," Kiyoshi said, raising an eyebrow.
"Yes, Kiyoshi," Rongi said, as unflinching as always. "As bad as some places we've been to in the Earth Kingdom." She kicked at the dust.
"I don't know what's happening in my own country anymore. Maybe I've been away for too long. I feel like an outsider."
Kiyoshi looked up at the second floors of the buildings and read the weathered signage hanging from the windows. There were a disproportionate number of inns for a town this size, which made sense if lots of visitors came and went. But there were also fresh banners draped from poles and awnings, displaying winged peonies, the sigil of the clan Zoryu's late mother belonged to. Their pristine state made Kiyoshi think of quilts that spent most of the year in the closet, used only during special occasions. "Is this Kiyoso clan territory?" she asked Rongi.
"The Kiyoso traditionally have the strongest influence on Shuhan Island, yes," Rongi said. "Though a lot of those flags are locals trying to win business. I'd bet they have a banner for every major clan stashed somewhere, waiting to be used."
"You know, I've never asked what clan you're from."
Throughout the entire time they'd known each other, Kiyoshi had failed to learn such a basic fact about her friend.
Rangi laughed. There was a roughness to the sound.
Sei Naka. Our symbol is a stylized whetstone. We come from a teeny tiny little island to the south of the capital. Sometimes it doesn't get included on maps made in the Earth Kingdom.
She purposely let a coarse up and down rhythm into her accent to let Kiyoshi know how great the social distance was from the royal palace, if not physical.
It has no resources to speak of, so my clan exports the talent and skills of its members. We're teachers, bodyguards, and soldiers because we have little else to fall back on. If we're not the best at what we do, then we're nothing.
Nothing. The word echoed with bitterness and dread in Rongi's throat, and through it, Kiyoshi saw deeper into the fires of her glowing girl than she ever had before. It was the fear of being nothing that put the steel in Rongi's words and actions. It made her unwilling to compromise, except, apparently, on the way she talked, even though Kiyoshi would fistfight anyone who thought there was any part of Rongi that warranted hiding. It explained the tension between her and her mother. Two perfectionists under the same pressure, locked in the same cage.
I'd like to see your home, Kiyoshi said. Your own little island. It sounds lovely.
Rongi smiled sadly.
I was going to take you there during the festival, but then this happened.
Kiyoshi brushed the backs of their hands together.
Someday, she said.
They slowed down so the rest of the group could catch up, walking as five the rest of the way. The town parted to let the view of the sea in. Between the caldera and the shore, the fairgrounds of North Chungling spread over the hard-packed sand. There was no ordered arrangement to the brightly colored tents and stalls. They made a forest of amusements to get lost in. Judging from the signs for games and betting and overpriced food and liquor, a heavy trail of money would be needed to navigate the maze. It was still morning, and this town lacked the penchant for earliness associated with the rest of the Fire Nation, so the barkers and dice dealers were still setting up. Once the fairground workers noticed the party arriving, a great hurrah rose into the air. The loud welcome was not for the Avatar or two Fire Nation nobles, but for Jinpa. The workers shouted, trying to get his attention.
Master, give me a blessing! Master Airbender, Master Baldi, over here!
I lost a koala sheep in the mountains. Give me the luck I need to find it!
Kiyoshi wasn't surprised by the reception. Outside of Yokoya, whose tight-fisted residents tended to view Kelsong as a nuisance, air nomads were often seen by Earth Kingdom common folk as bearers of good fortune. Since monks and nuns would have to stop at villages across the world along their journeys from temple to temple, most peasants gladly provided airbenders hospitality in exchange for help with chores, news, and entertaining stories from other parts of the world, or a promise to relay messages to distant relatives. Having an air nomad say a few words of spiritual blessing over a new barn or baby was considered great luck among those who rarely encountered members of the wandering nation. She was glad to see the same attitude prevailed here across the sea. Jinpa stepped forward and raised his glider staff.
May those whom this wind touches be successful in business and health, he shouted.
He whirled his staff with its tail fins open, creating a wide, gentle breeze that swept broadly over the fairground. It was a speedy and equitable distribution of luck, more efficient than trying to bless everyone in turn. The workers sighed and held their arms wide, trying to catch as much of the invisible wealth as possible. Jinpa closed his staff to the enthusiastic cheers of the crowd, a more boisterous response than the muted applause the fire nobles had given him.
I have no idea if any of that stuff works,
he whispered to his group. But it makes people happy.
Folk here seem less uptight than in the capital,
Atuat said. The stall vendors had noticed her polar origins and reasoned that if Atuat had traveled very far to be here, she must have had a lot of money. They shifted their attention away from Jinpa, who might have had the spirits on his side, but not cold hard cash.
Water Princess, they cried at Atuat. Queen of the Snow, this way for the best games, the best drinks, only the best for a queen.
I really should be treated like royalty more, Atuat said.
She smiled and waved at the workers, like a dignitary stationed atop a slowly moving carriage.
Can we trust you two to keep attention off the rest of our backs? Hadon said.
Of course, Jinpa said.
Sifu Atuat and I will see to it that the three of you can conduct your business with discretion.
She and I will... Oh dear, that's all of our money, isn't it?
Atuat was busy dumping a large purse of coins onto a table in exchange for gambling tokens. Jinpa nodded at Hadon as reassuringly as he could before joining the doctor. Hadon tried to tamp down the veins in her head with her fingers.
This is my punishment, she said.
Once she'd recovered from her friend-induced headache, she led them in a meandering path through the tents, choosing lefts and rights with certainty. Occasionally, she would stop and sniff at the air, her nostrils flaring.
Yes, it smells bad here, Rangi said. What were you expecting? We're near a rotting seaweed bed.
What I'm looking for has no odor, Hadon said. I'm trying to see if I'm getting any dizzier.
Instead of explaining her cryptic statement, she picked her way through two stalls that weren't meant to have a path between them. Their owners didn't appreciate her crossing the lines of business, but a sharp glare from the headmistress convinced them to withhold their objections. Kiyoshi felt compelled to mumble apologies as she wedged herself into the gap to keep up. They came to a large tent, all on its lonesome. It was made of cloth greased with flax oil, in the manner of ship sails designed to let as little air through them as possible. The structure looked so stained and flammable that an errant cough from a firebender would send the whole thing up in smoke. A sign posted outside said, "Spirit Visions of the Future." Either the characters were painted in wavy lines in a blurred approximation of a dreamlike state, or the painter simply didn't care enough to keep his strokes neat. Hadon lifted the entrance flap with the tip of her cane. The three of them ducked inside.
Welcome!
The sole occupant bellowed, throwing his arms in the air to hail his potential customers.
Are you interested in divining the secrets of the spirit world? Do you hunger for a glimpse of the great tapestry of the future? Unlike what fraudulent soothsayers and mystics might claim, dear visitor, the power for such visions lies within you. For a small price, let me merely be your humble guide.
Nyahutha, Hadon said. It's me.
The man blinked, adjusting to the light they'd let in.
Oh, he said, dropping his arms. It's you.
He was about Hadon's age. His pockmarked face bore the markers of a rougher life, more days in the open sun. He was wearing costume pieces intended to mimic a fire sage's ceremonial outfit, a pointed hat and wide shoulder pieces over bare arms. The effect was less convincing than Chae-jin's mock fire lord robes. The tent was empty except for some throw rugs and cushions. In the center, a metal device that resembled a charcoal brazier was jammed straight into the ground. There was no fuel in it, though. Only a small knob on the side of the pot. Kiyoshi hoped the man would offer them a seat so she could stop cricking her neck to fit inside the tent. But he and Hadon opted to stare at each other in cold silence, drawing upon what were obviously old memories and intense dislikes.
"Why are you here?"
Nyahitha said. He'd stopped shouting and was speaking to them in a quiet, clipped tone.
"Kuruk's reincarnation needs your help," Haydon said, gesturing to Kiyoshi.
That was Kiyoshi's least favorite way for people to refer to her avatarhood. But if it got her what she wanted, then fine.
She bowed to Nyahitha.
The sage pretender eyed her up and down. Kiyoshi had the same uncomfortable feeling of being bored into that Tagaka and Lao Ge had given her. Older folk who would find her dark depths before she could herself.
"Sit," he said.
He turned his back on them and left through the rear of the tent. They arranged themselves as best they could around the metal device.
"It would be great if Kiyoshi and I didn't have to waste time guessing what problems you have with this man," Rangi said. "Especially since you're the one who said we should meet him."
"It's simple,"
Nyahitha said, returning much quicker than Kiyoshi expected.
"The headmistress thinks I ruined Kuruk.
And Sage Nyahitha believes I and the rest of Kuruk's companions did,"
Haydon said. Neither of them was fazed by the other's open hostility. Nyahitha laid down a tray and filled teacups for each of them. Rongi picked hers up and frowned.
"Pardon me, but this is cold."
"No fires allowed,"
Nyahitha said.
"Do not create any heat in here."
Kiyoshi had never heard of a holy man of the Fire Nation eschewing flame. In fact, she was surprised he wasn't burning candles everywhere in the tent.
"Why?" she asked. "What is this place?"
Nyahitha sipped his ambient temperature tea. From his grimace, it was a concession rather than a preference.
"North Chungling is built over a deposit of flammable vapors. Instead of gold or silver, we have gas below our feet. If too much of it gets out in a concentrated place, a single spark will cause an explosion."
"But control the flow, and it becomes useful," Haydon said. Nyahitha shrugged.
"Useful is a strong word. The first visitors to North Chungling who reported spiritual visions likely stayed too long over cracks in the earth that let the gas rise naturally. Breathing the vapors will make you woozy and prone to hallucinating."
He flicked the bronze pot on the ground.
"This gadget, however, lets me moderate how much vapor comes out of a natural spout once I've located one."
"You're a fraud," Rongi growled, forgetting they were here to seek his assistance.
"You charge people for a spiritual vision, and then crank up the vapors until their eyes deceive them."
"Yes, I'm guilty of that."
Nyahitha clapped his hands together.
"Now what can this old fraud do for the Avatar?"
"Mother, we are not letting the scam artist anywhere near Kiyoshi."
Rongi made to get to her feet. Haydon grabbed her daughter by the side buckle of her armor and forced her back down.
"Despite my personal issues with him, Nyahitha was also a true fire sage, next in line for high sage before the Sawan clan played dirty with the selection process."
Kiyoshi thought of Kelsung, who would have been abbot of the Southern Air Temple before he fell from grace.
"I'd like to stay," she said.
Rongi huffed, but made no further protest. Nyahitha listened to Kyoshi's story from the beginning. He waited quietly and patiently, saying nothing, while she told him how the blood-drinking spirit named Father Glowworm had picked her out as Kuruk's reincarnation, and claimed Yun as his price for the task. Once she was done, the former sage leaned back and crossed his arms.
The curse strikes again,
he muttered.
What are you talking about? Kyoshi said. What curse?
That name you bring across my door is some very bad luck,
Nyahitha said.
Kuruk tangled with many hostile spirits during his avatarhood, and Father Glowworm was one of the worst. He never fully defeated it, and after their battle, it doomed him to suffer catastrophic fortune in the physical world. Anyone he told about Father Glowworm would be cursed in the same way. Anyone who even learned of its existence. I believe the intent was to isolate the Avatar from any allies he might call on to help him defeat the spirit for good.
There was an uncomfortable silence in the tent, the moment after opening a tomb.
With all due respect, a curse? Rangi said incredulously. Bad luck? Are we falling to superstitions now?
Misfortune from the spirits is what people across the four nations pray to ward off every day,
Nyahitha said.
Too little rain? Too much rain? Sickness? We're the fish school. These are matters of life and death. If you don't believe in curses, look at me. I used to be a leader at the High Temple back in those days, and where am I now? Kuruk didn't meet a happy end, and neither did Genju the architect, if what you told me is true.
Zoryu was supposedly cursed, Kyoshi thought. Many people in the Earth Kingdom thought ill of her in a similar manner. Fortune was an invisible, unconquerable creature that ruled common folk and noble alike.
You fell due to your own vices, Hadon said to Nyahitha, forgetting in anger that she was the one who had pushed for his help. Vices that you infected Kuruk with.
I tried to make sure at least some of the emptiness inside him was filled with purpose, he snapped. You, who spent so many years with him, what did you produce? A good pie show player? Some companions of the Avatar your lot were.
Excuses upon excuses for Kuruk. Kyoshi was sick of it. She slapped her hand on the earth beside her.
Kuruk was responsible for himself, she shouted. Now, are we going to weep over what could have been for the past Avatar? Or are we going to help the current one?
There was a hiss in reply. She dislodged the brazier planted in the middle of the tent. Nyahitha hastily recentered it and tightened the valve.
Did your boy have any strange features when you last saw him?
He asked.
Animal-like parts of his body?
Kyoshi shook her head. Not that I could see. But when he came back for the first time in Qinqiao, there was something wrong with him. I mean, palpably wrong. It was like he was making everyone around him sick and afraid.
I've never diagnosed a case of possession in the flesh, but I suppose he could have a spirit's essence inside him. It's difficult to say.
Please, Kyoshi said. She needed more than a cautious verdict from him. There has to be something else you can give me. Father Glowworm has to have some kind of weakness, a way to break its hold on my friend. She wasn't afraid of learning it would take a great battle for her to save Yun, or a quest through the worst places in the world. She was at home with such things. I can fight it, Kyoshi said. Just tell me how.
I don't have that knowledge,
Nyahitha said, deflating her hope.
Kuruk was the one who confronted wrathful spirits. I was just his handler on those missions.
Kyoshi wanted to scream inside the tent, took the breath to do it, until she remembered they had one last option. Then teach me how to ask him myself. Since he had no sleeves, Nyahitha wiped his nose on the cloth of his shoulder piece, crooking his neck. He stared at her as he did so, and Kyoshi could tell he was judging her worthiness, as if she were making the request for selfish reasons. She knew what it looked like when old folks decided a young person's fate was a light, weightless thing.
"Come back to me an hour before twilight," he said. "I can help you commune with Kuruk. Not through this noxious garbage, though. Don't inhale it. It'll rot you from the inside."
"Haven't you been breathing it with every single one of your customers?" Rongi asked. He smiled narrowly at her in response. A commotion came from outside. It was an angry noise, the brewing of trouble to come. Nyahitha got up and peeked out the tent flap. Whatever he saw made him swear through his teeth. "What is it?" Kyoshi asked.
"Sawan," he said. "They don't normally come to North Chungling."
Rongi's tongue lashing about running into situations headlong was still fresh in Kyoshi's mind. "Can we watch from here?" Nyahitha ran his hand through a sticky seam between the roof and the wall of the tent, letting the four of them peer through the crack. It felt a bit childish, lining up in a row to peep, but it worked. Kyoshi could see the scrubby open area that surrounded Nyahitha's stall. Heading straight for them was a large procession of nobility. The column traveled by foot, bearing a giant palanquin swathed in red and gold silks. Surrounding it was a contingent of armored warriors. These men and women looked ready for a battle, not a day at the beach. They held their jaws with an arrogance designed to provoke. And they were personally adorned with so many stone camellia designs that the great flapping banner of the Sawan clan they carried at the head of the procession was wholly unnecessary. The stall vendors, who had been eager for customers earlier, were not happy to see them. Many of them left their booths and formed up a mob to meet the arriving Sawan. One middle-aged man with bushy sideburns stood at the front of the pack. He was very well-dressed compared to the rest of the fairground workers, but they seemed to rally around him rather than resent him for it.
"That's Sanshir Kyoso," Nyahitha said. "He's the town's cotton merchant and the fair's main sponsor."
The palanquin came to a stop, its bearers carefully lowering the box to the ground. The occupant stepped out. She was a pretty woman with a thin, puckered face, wearing outrageously expensive robes. Kyoshi was certain she had not been at the royal palace reception. Such grandiose taste would have stood out.
"Lady Huazo," Rongi said. "Chejin's mother. I'm not sure why she's slumming it in North Chungling."
Nyahitha gave her comment an angry squint, but went back to watching. Huazo and Sanshir Kyoso approached each other like the principals in a duel. Speaking for the benefit of the respective contingents like stage players meant they were loud enough for Kyoshi's group to hear from inside the tent.
"Master Sanshir," Huazo said. "How good to see you. I've written you so many letters with no response, I began to worry for your health."
"My health is fine, Huazo," the fairground leader said. "And I could have saved you the visit. The answer to your inquiries, as it remains since the first time I gave it, is no. The fair is not for sale, nor the croplands. My cousins have agreed. Not a single square inch of Shuhan Island will ever fall into the hands of the Sawan."
Huazo licked her lips and grinned.
"That's funny," she said. "Given how I recently purchased Master Lin Su's entire salt-making operation down the shore, and his vacation house right here in town, I suppose he's not as loyal to his home as you are. He couldn't wait to pack up and leave this place."
Sanshir's eyes turned muddy with rage. The crowd behind him grew heated. Huazo drank in their reactions like water in a desert.
"After I signed the papers, it occurred to me I should celebrate the festival of Sito in the newest outpost of my clan," she said. "And thus, here I am."
With so many of your household guards,
Sanshur said, staring at the Sawan force.
For my own safety. Haven't you heard? Last night an assassin, a madman, an earthbender of all people, infiltrated the royal palace.
Huazo had to cover her own mouth to keep her shock and distress from spilling out.
Members of the court were nearly killed, and it happened right under our dear Fire Lord Zoryu's nose. I'm told it was humiliating, absolutely humiliating.
Hadon grimaced inside the tent.
Chajin must have gotten messenger hawks out to his clan immediately after the attack. The Sawan are like shark squids when they smell blood.
That doesn't explain why Huazo's tromping around in the middle of Kyoso territory instead of seeing to her new business, Rongi said.
Kyoshi watched the news of Yun's attack ripple through the Kyoso side. The fairground workers understood the implications for Zoryu's honor, as well as nobles would. She became keenly aware that many of Sanshur's men were holding large hammers used to drive tent stakes into the ground. Ice saws as big as swords, pieces of driftwood that served no purpose, other than being heavy clubs.
I know what she's doing, Kyoshi said. She's picking a fight.
Sometimes when a Daofei gang wanted to go to war but cared about appearing in the right, they made themselves vulnerable by strolling through enemy streets, noses held high, hoping to provoke a small amount of violence upon themselves that could be answered with overwhelming force. Zoryu had told her this was part of the Sawan strategy. They preferred a Kyoso to strike at them first.
Watch what you say about our rightful Fire Lord, Sanshur growled.
I'm simply stating facts, Huazo said. Check with anyone you care to back in the capital. The Inta or the Lahaisin. I heard Lady Mizgan nearly had to have her foot amputated from her injuries. Anyway, I'm not here to debate the strength and capabilities of young Zoryu. I simply came to your lovely little village to enjoy myself and take the waters.
She looked toward the sea and peered at the rancid algae foaming up on the shore.
Well, you know what I mean. I hope to run into you again, Master Sanshur.
She walked leisurely back to her palanquin. It looked like the crisis might have been averted, but a member of her vanguard, out of sight of his lady, made eye contact with Sanshur. Then, as a farewell, he spat on the ground.
Please tell me that's less of an insult here than in the Earth Kingdom, Kyoshi whispered.
Rongi and Hadon gave her an answer by bursting out of the tent, making for the space between the battle lines as fast as they could.
Kyoshi glanced at Nyahitha.
Go after them,
the old man yelled. She joined the charge not a moment too soon. Several large stones flew from the Kyoso side, aimed at Huazo's turned back. With a series of punches, she altered the trajectory of the rocks with immense force, sending them so far out into the ocean she couldn't hear the splashes of them land.
Lady Huazo, is that you?
Hadon cried out with exaggerated joy, making sure she drew more attention than the attack. Huazo turned around with a frown. It lingered for a moment as she took in the surprise, but she quickly adjusted it into a wide smile.
Hadon, as I live and breathe.
The sudden presence of the headmistress was enough to make Huazo's side stand down. Hands left the hilts of their swords, and the soldiers stepped back to give their lady space to greet her old acquaintance. Kyoshi focused on keeping her fellow rabble in line by standing in front of the Kyoso mob. They might not have known who she was, but she didn't need recognition to be intimidating. She gestured at Sanshur and his men with her eyes. Did you see what I did to those rocks,
What a wonderful surprise, Hadon said,
as if she hadn't been listening in for the past few minutes.
Are you here to celebrate the holiday as well?
Yes, I was just telling.
Huazo stopped mid-sentence. Her eyes drifted to Hadon's head.
She pressed her fingers to her lips again, her shock genuine this time. Hadon stared back until it struck her. She'd forgotten her hair had been cut in dishonor. Her hands tightened around her cane. She backed away from Huazhou, her eyes downcast. Kyoshi had thought she understood the significance of the ceremony before, but she'd been wrong. Huazhou was the first Fire National of notable rank they'd met since Hadon lost her topknot, and the proud, invincible headmistress was acting like she no longer had the right to speak. Huazhou's stance shifted. She went from being caught off guard by a formidable presence to having the bearing of an almsgiver in front of a wandering mendicant.
"Oh, my dear," she said softly. "Did this have anything to do with the attack on the palace?"
"It did," Hadon said. She'd found her strength and calmness again. There was no shame in answering her newfound better. "Among other failures."
"How fate and fortune rule us all," Huazhou said. She thought for a moment. "Hadon, honor is honor, but friendship is friendship. I will never disavow you, no matter the circumstances."
She reached out for an embrace, and Kiyoshi was nearly ready to change her opinion of the woman. But then, Huazhou used her extended hand to pat Hadon on the head, like she would a child. Or a pet. Kiyoshi tried to gauge Rongi's reaction, but Rongi was blank, zeroed out, a null in the ledger. Her gaze bored through Huazhou and into the stars beyond. If she wasn't moving, if she wasn't immediately challenging Huazhou to an Agni Kai, then it was acceptable for Huazhou to treat Hadon like this. According to the rules of etiquette, it was acceptable. Hadon didn't look perturbed at all. She endured Huazhou's ruffle of her shortened locks with nary a frown. She was less upset than the Kyoso commoners, who murmured and scowled at the ungraciousness on display. After what felt like an eternity, Huazhou let go. She turned to examine the rest of Hadon's group.
"That would make you the Avatar," she said to Kyoshi.
After what she'd done, the rules of introduction were an afterthought. "I am," Kyoshi said, finding it difficult to speak with Rongi in turmoil a few feet away. "I suppose your son wrote to you about me."
"He did. Our family is twice blessed for both of us to meet you in such a short time."
"When you write him back, give him a message for me." Kyoshi hardened her gaze. "Tell him he makes a good fire sage, and nothing more." Huazhou's lips parted as she figured out what Kyoshi was saying. It was interesting to watch her mind work and her face try to hide it. Deducing what the Avatar knew and what her son might have revealed. The conclusion that she would have to go through Kyoshi to get to Zoryu didn't worry her in the slightest. A happy noise came from Rongi, so out of place that Kyoshi nearly drew her weapons in surprise.
"Colin!"
Rongi's feet dug into the sand as she ran to meet one of Huazhou's guards on the far edge of the formation. She was a girl their age who was equally delighted to see her. She had a round, pleasant face and wore her hair almost identical to Rongi's.
"Rongi!"
The two girls nearly collided. They clutched each other's hands and grinned, oblivious to their surroundings. The sudden turnaround in Rongi's mood was bizarre.
"My niece, Colin," Huazhou explained to Kyoshi. "Those two were the same year at the academy. The bonds forged in school, over the anvil of education, are stronger than any other. I'm sure you understand."
Huazhou would have known that as an Earth Kingdom peasant, the odds of Kyoshi having a level of formal education similar to Rongi or Colin were nil. Her petty dig hurt less than the way Rangi's face shone for her friend. She couldn't remember ever being greeted in such a manner. Seeing she'd scored a hit, Huazo decided to leave on a high note. She made a show of covering her small-mouthed yawn.
"Apologies, Avatar. I'm so exhausted from my journey. I should make for my lodgings. I'm sure I'll see you and your companions during the festivities. Colin, come now."
Rangi and Colin reluctantly pulled themselves apart. Huazo got back in her palanquin. Kyoshi, with feet planted, watched the laborious, lengthy process of the Sawan contingent reorganizing itself. It turned its head like the slowest serpent in the world, without any spitting this time, and marched back to town. Sanshir Kyoso suddenly appeared by Kyoshi's side, gazing at the retreating column with her, as if the task of seeing off the Sawan had required the two of them equally.
"Fork-tongued fiends they are. I'm glad the Avatar's here to keep them in line."
She glared at him. "It was your side I caught throwing rocks."
"Huazo and her clan have been biting off chunks of the other islands like lion vultures," he said, as if that was an excuse for the behavior of his kin. "I'll be a cremated pile of ashes before I let her have Shuhan. Her and that by-blow son of hers." "We're not rubes," another man shouted from the fairground crowd. "We know about the dirty tricks Chae-Jin the usurper is pulling in court."
"We support the legitimate Fire Lord Zoryu. Long may his flame burn," Sanshir said.
"Are you going to tell us we're wrong for being loyal to the crown?"
"The Fire Lord doesn't need you starting violence for him."
"So we should let them insult us? Like what she did to your companion?"
Kyoshi had no answer for that. She looked to Rangi and Heiron, but they said nothing. There must have been some kind of Fire Nation rule at work, where they couldn't in good conscience tell their own countrymen how to interpret their personal dishonor.
"Don't worry," Sanshir declared. "We've got your back against the Ma'inka worms. You can count on us."
The fairground workers rattled their tools, shouting praises of the Avatar and the Fire Lord while heaping scorn upon the Sawan. Heidon stepped closer to Kyoshi.
"Let's just leave," she whispered. "Remember, we have a mission here. If we get caught up in this nonsense, we'll make it worse."
"Are you sure? Sanshir's men seem really riled up."
"It's not Sanshir's men I'm worried about."
Heidon glanced at her daughter. Rangi stared out to sea, lost somewhere in the churning waves. Leaving wasn't easy. They had to wander the tents, looking for Atuat and Jinpa. They found them near the gambling tents, offering the highest stakes. The monk appeared to have aged a decade, sweat and furrows marking his brow.
"I had a run of bad luck," Atuat explained. "But Jinpa here got us back to break even."
The remnants of shock lingered on his face, like he'd witnessed the desecration of a holy relic.
"I've never seen anyone play Paisho quite like the doctor. You'd almost have to be a genius at the game to do what she did."
At this point, Kiyoshi was simply glad the two of them hadn't drowned in the sea or gotten stuck in a hole. They headed back to town. As they walked, Heidon gave Kyoshi another meaningful look. Rangi was storming off ahead of the group. Kyoshi caught up with her, but was at a loss for what to say. "It's nice to know there's at least one tolerable Sawan," she ventured. "Colin must remind you of the good old academy days."
"Kyoshi," Rangi said slowly, "I was miserable at the academy."
"What?" She nearly stopped in her tracks. "Weren't you the number one student in your class? Didn't you graduate from officer's school early?"
"Those things aren't mutually exclusive," Rangi said. "I had motivation to get the scores I did. I couldn't get out of that place fast enough."
There must have been signs Kyoshi missed along the way.
How else could she have misunderstood such an integral part of Rangi's life so badly?
I'm sorry. I didn't know.
It's not your fault. I've only mentioned bits and pieces of those days, never the full story.
Her tone was carefully measured, composed with effort.
You do remember when I told you the other students used to spread rumors and gossip about my mother, right?
I do. It had been a secret shared on an iceberg drifting in the ocean, the two of them lying under the same blanket together. Not circumstances easily forgotten. Rongi jutted her chin in the direction of the town. Kiyoshi knew she was pointing at Kolin, wherever Huazo's niece was.
It's a Saowan signature technique, delivering insults with plausible deniability. There were some vicious little monsters at school, but her? She was the worst.
You couldn't call her out?
Kiyoshi wasn't sure at what age the Fire Nation allowed Agni Kai's. And after what she'd personally been through on the Leitai, she had mixed feelings about the practice of duels in general. But she assumed the behavior Rongi was describing would have ended in some kind of challenge.
Rongi shook her head.
She was careful not to say anything to my face that warranted it. She left that to cronies who were too weak for me to confront without looking like a bully. I know exactly how Lord Zoryu feels, trying to win a war of insults against an enemy he can't confront.
She bit her lip, trying to convince herself more than anyone.
And what could I have done, really? I was the headmistress's daughter. Any fights I got into would have reflected poorly on her, or made it look like I was abusing my status. Was I supposed to go whining to a teacher that the other kids were saying mean things about my mother?
Kyoshi couldn't believe it. I thought the academy was this wonderful experience that shaped you.
It did. I learned everything I know there. But I wasn't happy until I left and found a purpose on the outside.
She gave Kyoshi a tilted smile, full of heartbreak.
Serving the Avatar.
Kelsung used to say there was pain and joy in all things, often when trying to comfort Kyoshi about her earliest years in Yokoya. During her visit to the Fire Nation, Kyoshi had been thrilled each time she discovered another little cache of information about Rangi, like unearthing another bit of treasure. But under the shine was life, grubby and dirty, and impossible to burnish. She would take it anyway. Along with everything else about her girl, no matter how unexpected or painful, it took every ounce of her willpower not to lean over and give the firebender a forbidden kiss on the top of her head. Together they walked down the street that bisected the guest districts, cutting across the wedges of restaurants and shops. Rongi pointed out some festival-related traditions they saw along the way. Paper streamers strung over doorways were meant to comb the entering visitors for good luck. Shopkeepers cooked pots of beans to represent the inventories being counted. The dark sugary drinks sold everywhere symbolized the prodigious amount of ink Avatar Sito used over his career. Had it not been for the unpleasantness by the beach, they could have pretended they were here to enjoy themselves. But reality intruded yet again. Once they rounded the corner of the inn they were staying at, a huddle of men came into view. Kiyoshi could tell from the clouds of dust and swearing, the way their fists rose and fell, what lay at the center of the ring. Their victim. She lowered her shoulder into two of the men at once, sending them flying away from the group. Rongi took the other two attackers by the backs of their collars and yanked down, slamming them to the ground. Kiyoshi expected the dazed and bleeding youth they'd been beating to be a Saowan,
isolated from Huazo's group, but judging from his clothes, he was a local like the other four men.
"What is going on here?"
she bellowed.
"We caught this traitor putting up a stone camellia banner over his stall,"
said one of the men, wriggling in Rongi's grasp.
"I just wanted some business,"
mumbled the young vendor as he shakily got to his knees.
"And that was more important to you than the honor of your clan? No nephew of mine is going to toady up to the Sawan."
The ringleader tried to kick more dust in the direction of his beaten kinsman. Kiyoshi shared a worried look with Rongi. It had taken less than an hour since the arrival of the Sawan for a fight to break out, and it hadn't even been between rival clans. Kiyoshi could see the grains of violence crystallizing into a fuller shape. Under their feet, North Chungling was priming to explode. Spiritual Exercises.
"It doesn't surprise me they were related,"
Nyahitha said when Kiyoshi told him about the active battery she'd stopped.
"Enemies are enemies, but no one can shame you like your own family."
She and Rongi had immediately hauled the offenders to the town jail, but the local judge's indifferent response to the crime and his strong family resemblance to the uncle of the victim meant it was unlikely they'd be locked up for longer than overnight. She would have to remember the troublemakers' faces if she saw them around town in the morning. Kyoshi followed Nyahitha on a narrow path that crept along the rim of the caldera. It was just the two of them. Her entire party had shown up to his tent at the appointed time. He'd taken one look at the motley group before declaring that spiritual breakthroughs were not a group activity. He would need the Avatar alone. Climbing up here had been sweaty work in the humidity of the island. It was easier to talk now, exposed to cooling breezes that ran across the edges of the cliff heights.
"It's not a good sign, though," Nyahitha said. "Fights don't usually break out until later in the festival, once the alcohol starts flowing. I'm sure you have plenty of drunken aggression in the Earth Kingdom, but here, where you've got to avenge every stupid slight upon your name?"
He grimaced.
"I tell you, I don't love that part about my country."
Kiyoshi knew the feeling. The Earth Kingdom's hide-bound corrupt habits had caused her no end of grief.
"At least there won't be any Agni Kais,"
Nyahitha said.
"It's a spiritual offense to burn another person during a holiday."
They walked farther until they came to a bluff that overlooked a growing plain, a flattened gentle slope that bore the marks of plow and hoe. Most of the ground had been upturned and emptied.
"There's not enough light to see it clearly now, but over there are the melon yam fields,"
Nyahitha said, pointing to a still green patch on the opposite side of the village.
"They're an extremely sensitive crop, so they stay in the ground until the very end of the festival. I'd be surprised if they even survive that long, though. This town is withering, Avatar. The tourist money helps, but it's not enough."
"Do you think the rumors are true? Could the spirits be angry at Lord Zoryu for some reason?"
"Man guesses. Spirits act,"
Nyahitha said, trotting out an old expression.
"You could try asking them yourself once you figure out how."
He pointed to a stump on another nearby clearing.
"That's where we'd tie up your flying bison if you had one."
Kiyoshi frowned. "I do have a bison, or at least access to one."
"What?"
Nyahitha's shout echoed in the evening air.
"Why didn't you say so? We've been hiking for an hour. We could have flown here in minutes."
"You didn't tell me where we were going. I thought the walking was part of the spiritual exercise." The two of them held back from swearing at each other. Between the Flying Opera Company's obsession with Pong Pong and Nyahitha's grumbling that she hadn't brought Ying Yong,
Kyoshi was beginning to think the world would be better off if the Avatar simply reincarnated as a sky bison from now on. At least then, it would be universally beloved.
All right, just sit,
Nyahitha said.
Anywhere is fine as long as you give me some space in front of you.
Kyoshi took her position. We're not doing incense, are we? She'd had bad experiences with incense, to say the least.
No, we're not doing incense.
Nyahitha's approach seemed to forego as many spiritual trappings as possible. He'd left behind his ridiculous fake fire sage outfit and wore a simple cotton robe, notably devoid of any clan symbols. You know, I just thought of something, Kyoshi said as he sat down across from her. If it doesn't work out with Kuruk, you could guide me to Yangchen. She mediated between humans and spirits. Nyahitha let out a long hiss through his teeth.
I don't think Yangchen will be as much help as you think.
That's nonsense. Yangchen was the perfect avatar, or at least better than Kuruk in every way possible. She'd be able to help me somehow.
If you reached her, maybe. Some sages, including me, believe you have to go down the chain of your past lives in reverse order if you want to communicate with them. You can't talk to Yangchen or the older avatars before you manage to connect with Kuruk.
Great, Kyoshi said, throwing up her hands and breaking her meditative posture. So on top of everything else, Kuruk's a wall keeping me from my full potential.
He's not a... I swear, I would have known you were his reincarnation from the start and saved the Earth Kingdom a lot of trouble had they brought you before me. You two are exactly alike.
Kyoshi sputtered, indignant to her very core. How dare, the nerve of him to insinuate such a... Nyahitha quickly constructed a list on his fingers.
You both idolize Yangchen to a fault. You're both stubborn as rocks when it comes to what you want, and neither of you have any control over your emotions. Mark my words, you're going to botch up bad someday because of your personal feelings, just like he did.
I'm glad you could tell all of that from the two conversations we had. Kyoshi had thought the days of mystical tutors unilaterally declaring who she really was inside were over, but apparently not. Now, can we get down to business? Nyahitha wiped his mouth and calmed himself into a state more becoming of an avatar's spiritual guide.
There's a number of ways Kuruk might talk to us, he explained. The most straightforward is if you were to simply have a vision of him. This method tends to be successful in locations with meaning for the past avatars. This spot right here was where Kuruk would meditate and recover from his own spiritual journeys.
A vision in an important location to the water avatar. That could explain his appearance in the Southern Air Temple. And, she thought with some displeasure, the wreckage he'd made of Yangchen's island.
The downside is that any messages you get from a vision tend to be one way only,
Nyahitha said.
Not as useful if you have to ask him questions. Another way to have more of a conversation is if he took over your body and spoke to me in person. I would have to relay whatever you want to ask him.
Kyoshi frowned. She was distinctly uncomfortable with the idea of being possessed by someone else. Kuruk was one of the last people she wanted controlling her body, even if he was her own past life. Nyahitha noticed her reluctance.
If you don't like that, the final method, which is the most difficult and least likely to happen after one session of practice, is if you manage to meditate your way into the spirit world. There, you could talk to him face to face. This is the level of communing that most people associate with the Avatar's abilities. It's the most efficient and clear way to draw on the wisdom of previous generations.
He paused. But? Kiyoshi asked.
Kuruk's spirit isn't necessarily going to be there to greet you, and your body is rendered physically helpless while your spirit is on the other side. And sometimes you don't remember anything you learned once you come back to the physical world.
Maybe she was better off inhaling the gas inside the dirty tent. Communing doesn't sound like the great and useful power it's described to be.
Nothing is useful until you practice it.
Nyahitha brought